We're on Proverbs 17 now, and we've seen this one a number of times. I think God scattered it through the Proverbs enough to keep repeating it so he convinces you, because it's hard to convince you this is true. Better is a dry morsel and quietness therewith than a house full of good with strife. Now, sacrifices, it shouldn't be translated sacrifices there, because that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about abundance or good or plenty. So you can have a house full of plenty and a house full of good, choice tidbits, but if you got strife there, you know, it's shocking how much your attitude and nerves play on everything else. You can be the most rigid, balanced diet person there is, but if you're always uptight and always hassling, you can get boils with the best diet on earth with a bad attitude or a fear or a trouble or a worry. I remember a minister that came out to work with me one time, and he couldn't forget people's problems. He couldn't leave them at night. So he just had to learn that, but he got worried, and you know, he was the most diligent man I've ever seen about eating. You couldn't get him to stop off for a milkshake or run by and get a hamburger or something. He was very rigid and very diligent. He got boils one time. I couldn't believe that. He'd get boils, and he was so diligent about eating the right way. But I remember we were visiting in Indiana one time, and I called his name out, and he jumped about 3 inches, almost hit his head on the ceiling of the car. I said, "Boy, oh boy, are you ever keyed up. You better get over, let me drive. Now, you need to unwind a little bit or get out of that pressure and that fear, that trouble that way." So if you don't have a relaxed, at ease spirit, it doesn't make a difference about your diet. But you're better off with an old dry morsel. If you've got quietness with it, your digestive juices will take care of that dry morsel, but they can't handle that pressure, you know, that'd give you ulcers. A wise servant shall have rule over a son that causes shame. Now, boy, you can see that fulfilled many times. You know, I've seen that fulfilled many a time right here in God's work, where many men who've come along and become wise servants are in positions now that a son used to be in. And how many times can you see that? Over and over and over that happens, where God looked down and see a wise servant. A good example of that's back in 1 Kings 11, and in verse 11, you want to drop the tie of scripture in with it. I've written kids right across verse 2, because it teaches you a lesson there that if you're a son that causes shame, then almost anybody and everybody's going to be the heir or have rule over a son that causes shame. And a wise servant shall have part of the inheritance among the brethren. So it's not odd that a lot of people treat total strangers, family-wise, equal with family when it comes to inheritance. God prophesied that. God decreed that. That's a law. So if you become a wise servant, that may be the way you end up. Verse 3. The refining pot is for silver, and the furnace is for gold. But in the very same way that the refining pot melts away impurities and leaves pure silver, and a furnace melts away the impurities and leaves gold, that's the way God does people's hearts. If you don't let God wash your robes and make them white, tribulation will. If you don't allow God to wash you with the water of the Word and make you part of the bride that's ready for the marriage, then tribulation, the fire of tribulation, will do it. So the Eternal tries the hearts, and he has to have ways of trying the hearts. So God allows people to make mistakes, and God's always sifting, always weeding out. Verse 4, a wicked doer gives heed to false lips, and a liar gives ear to a naughty tongue. So if you give ear to a naughty tongue, God says you're a liar, and if you give heed to false lips, you're a wicked doer. So be careful what you let your ears hear, and keep your ears away from wrong. Now, there are ways of doing that. You know, if you just avoid the presence of people ahead of time. But once you've let yourself get into the presence of people like that, and then you say, well, you know, it doesn't sound like this is the kind of conversation I want to be around, and you take off. People say, well, look at old Holy Joe there. You know, so to avoid it ahead of time is a better wisdom, not to depart from it after you're in it. Now, that's second best. I mean, I'm not saying that's wrong. That's right. But that's only second best. You're better off staying away from it in the first place. Verse 5, whoso mocks the poor reproaches his maker. Because God hadn't made all of us, in a sense, with the same abilities and the same... In God's sight, some people have talents that aren't related to being able to make money. Others have talents that are related to making money. You might jot down here Job 31 and notice a couple of scriptures there in Job 31, verse 15. Did not he who made me in the womb make the poor man too? Did not one fashion us? Then verse 29, Job 31. If I rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me, or lifted up myself when evil found him. So you can't mock the poor, or you can't be glad at calamities. And that one chapter of Job answers both of those, or gives you an illustration of it. Whoever mocks the poor reproaches his maker. God said you'll always have the poor among you. You know, Jesus said that in the New Testament. When they condemned Mary for using the precious ointment on his feet. And he said, the poor you have always with you. So there'll always be people who don't have the knack of making money like some do. He that's glad at calamities shall not be held innocent. The Hebrew says, it doesn't say you'll not be unpunished. It says you won't be held innocent. It doesn't say what's going to happen to you if you are glad at calamities. So when you pray for your enemy, you can't ask God to smite his teeth out and be glad of his calamity. You know, you're carnal when you do that, so God let a little bit of David's carnality show through in the book. Verse 6. Nobody really needs to read this one. Everybody knows this. Children's children are the crown of old men. Nothing like grandkids. Boy, you know, everybody's always got pictures of grandkids to show. So, grandchildren, they're the crown of old men. And the glory of children are their fathers. Children just love grandpa, and they love great-grandpa, you know, and their dad, you know. Kids want to grow up to be like their dad, when they're little at least. The glory of children, you know. He doesn't say teenagers, says children. So, God, you have to be careful about the words for kids, you know. God has, that's one of the realities of the Christmas story in the New Testament. You know, God had a word for little babies that were conceived and not yet born. And then he has another word for little bitty babies after they're circumcised on the eighth day up until they're a couple of years old. Then he has another word for little kids from 2 up to about 6 or so. And then another word for up to 12. And then another word for teenagers. And boy, they got all kinds of specialized words for different age brackets. And you better be sure you notice that. So when he says, train up a child, you know what he's saying. That's when you have to start, you know, when they're a child. But the word here is children, not teens. The glory of children are their fathers. Now, verse 7. This one, you know, I've seen this one fulfilled in a spokesman's club. You can teach people mechanically how to be good speakers. You can teach people by keeping them in a spokesman's club for 10 years, excellent speech becomes not a fool. If you don't have it in the brain, what good does it do to be able to eloquently express your fools? Intelligence, you know, it doesn't do any good. But I've seen that happen, you know, where men would develop mechanical abilities and yet excellent speech becomes not a fool. But in the same way, lying lips don't become a prince. A man who's in line to be a royal ruler over a nation, boy, lying lips just are even much less becoming to a prince. a gift. This isn't the word bribe in this case. This word gift means talent, skill, ability, or aptitude. A talent or an aptitude or a skill or an ability that God has given you as a gift is a precious stone in the eyes of him that has it. So one of the modern warped ideas is that it's vanity to recognize your talents. Now, you shouldn't let your talents cause you to be vain. You didn't have a thing to do with getting them, you know. They're hereditary. You didn't say, wait a minute, God, I don't want to be born yet. I want to wait and get onto these genes and chromosomes later, you know. And you didn't have a thing to do with it, you know. Whatever you are, you can't claim any vanity about it. If people just realize that. You know, Paul said in one place about boasting, he said, what do you have that wasn't given you? You know, what do you have that wasn't given you? You inherit your grandma's nature and your granddad's nature and your aunt and uncle's nature and your aunt and uncle's talents and all that. Now, you could flounder it and let it go to waste. That's true. And if you sharpen your talents and use them, you deserve credit for it. But don't get puffed up and cocky as if you had something to do with acquiring your aptitudes. They're gifts. They're gifts. But they ought to be a precious stone in the eyes of him that has it. Wherever it turns, it prospers. It'll accomplish its purpose wherever it turns. Any talents that are used that are gifts from God, they'll always bring value. They'll always be productive. They'll always prosper and do you good. Now, verse 9, he that covers a transgression seeks love. Now, it isn't talking about your own. It's talking about somebody else's you know about. We've read this in chapter 10, verse 12. You want to jot down some parallels. Chapter 19, verse 11, we'll read it again. It's his glory to pass over a transgression. The discretion of a man defers his anger, and it's his glory to pass over a transgression. So there's somebody transgressing against you, and you're big enough to ignore it and forgive it and forget it and pay no attention to it. But if you cover a transgression, then you're one who seeks love. But if you repeat a matter, you can separate very friends by repeating a matter. You know, all of us say things we shouldn't say at times. We wish we'd never said them. So if people are good enough to just forget you said it, then that's great. You know, why catalog everything everybody always says? You know, I'd hate for my wife to have a tape recorder around the house all the time so she records everything I ever say. And then place it back and say, now see, there you said that. And see, here, listen to all you said. You know, that'd be horrible, wouldn't it? I've had people say, well, did you say this 6 years ago? Well, I can't even remember what I said 6 months ago. You know, don't ask me what I said 6 years ago. I can't even more remember that than anything. So, he that repeats the matter separates friends. You know, it's kind of a challenge sometimes to know something and not ever say anything about it. Just never let anybody know. You know something and nobody ever finds out you knew. That's really an accomplishment. Especially when God says, last enemy, everybody overcomes their tongue. Verse 10. A reproof enters more into a wise man than 100 stripes into a fool. Now, this type of fool is one that won't listen to correction or instruction. So if you reprove a wise man, a lot of times you don't have to be very strong or very powerful or repeat it 6 or 8 times so you drive it in deeper and deeper and deeper. If a man's a wise man, then reproof enters more into him than 100 stripes into a fool. An evil man seeks only rebellion. Therefore, a cruel messenger will be sent against him. So somehow, if you're an evil man, everything's going to seem to be bad on you, going against you. Evil messengers out against you. Verse 12, God shows how much he knew about nature because he put the nature in creatures. A bear robbed of her whelps. That's about as bad as you can get, you know. You want to really be in trouble, you rob a bear of her whelps. But you'd be better off letting a bear robbed of her whelps meet a man rather than a fool in his folly. because they can do you more harm if you get caught up in it and get carried away by it, and they'll do you more harm than a bear robbed of her whelps. Now, verse 13, whoever rewards evil for good, evil shall not depart from his house. Well, David's an example of that. Uriah, David rewarded evil for his good. When he came in, he wouldn't even go into his wife because his soldiers were out there in the battlefield and they didn't get to come in and see their wives. Why should he? So he slipped out doors on the ground with his men that came in with him. Well, evil never did depart from David's house. He had war all his days, never did even get to finish the walls and do what he wanted to do. That's frightening, you know. But that's what happens. If someone comes to you with good and you reward them evil for the good they do to you, boy, you might as well look and see what's happening to you. And if I were a person who just seems to have everything happening to me, I would look back and say, well, now let's see now. Did somebody reward me evil sometime back there and they rewarded me good and I rewarded them evil? Yeah, I think I did. You know, old so-and-so came and he meant well. He was wanting to help me, and look what I did to him. Boy, I better find him and straighten that out, and maybe I can get this evil from off my house. Because that's a law. Evil shall not depart from his house. Whoever rewards evil for good. And you can think of a lot of famous times in history that proverb's been fulfilled. Now, that's really a gem of one there. Verse 14. Here's good wisdom. You know what happens when you start letting a little water over a dam? Well, you ought to know that's what's going to happen when strife begins. So you've got to stop it when it's small. You've got to stop it before it gets deep and spread out and big. The beginning of strife is as when one lets out water. Therefore, leave off contention before it be meddled with. Stop it before it gets out of control. Catch it when it's small, when it just started. Carnally, you know, people argue even when they know they're wrong. They'll still argue. They just don't want to admit they're wrong, even when they know they're wrong. He that justifies the wicked, and he that condemns the just, even they both are abomination to the Eternal. You know, and it doesn't make any difference whether they're your friend or whether they're somebody you can't stand by their nature. You can never justify the wicked, no matter who they are. And you can never condemn the just, if you don't like them or not. It doesn't make any difference. If you do any one of those, you're an abomination to the Eternal. Wherefore is there a price in the hand of a fool to get wisdom? Think of all these people that go to college, you know. Money in their hand. They're going to college. Get wisdom. But if they have no heart for it, how ridiculous. Wherefore is there a price in their hand to get wisdom when they're a fool? They don't have any heart for it. Now verse 17 really does some separating. A friend loves at all times. You ever weigh how you feel about somebody, you know, and one day they say something good about you, and you know, I like old Bill Smith. Boy, he's all right, you know. He's not bad at all. And a few weeks after that, somebody tells you they said something about you. Well, you know, that guy is really a rat, you know. that guy is really a dud. And isn't that ridiculous that you change your estimation of somebody else by what they said about you or how they feel about you? Now, that's unfair judgment. A friend loves at all times. Not just when you're good to him or when you encourage him, inspire him, or pat him on the back, but when you sharpen him like iron sharpens iron, or you give him hearty counsel, or you correct him, or whatever. A friend loves at all times. And a brother is born for adversity. That's when people are needed, you know. I see people at funerals, and they'll say, now, look, if there's any time I can ever help with anything, be sure to let me know.
And they see him again. But they soothe their conscience by telling that other person that, you know. If you're really meant to help somebody like that, boy, it is lonesome after you lose someone. And to have somebody come and visit you and just spend a little time a few days after, a few weeks after, boy, that means a great deal, you know.
But to be there at the funeral and make a comment like that, that just soothes your own conscience. A brother is born for adversity. So anytime a brother has adversity, boy, you gotta go at 2 or 3 in the morning. You ought to drive 500 miles. You know, anytime a brother's in adversity, that's when you prove you're a real brother. A friend loves at all times. Now, verse 18, a man void of understanding, and hear the words heart again, a man that's void of character, a man that's void of heart, of character, he gets influenced and he becomes surety. He strikes hands, shakes hands. You know, in Norway, they still strike hands. They don't even shake hands. They didn't like give me five, whack, whack, you know, but it's similar to that. They just slap hands sideways like that instead of grabbing it and shaking it. So, a man void of understanding strikes hands, becomes surety in the presence of his friend. There again, you notice, still doesn't say brother. It always says friend, neighbor, everybody else except brother. Verse 19, he loves transgression that loves strife. I remember one of our ministers, this didn't ring the bells with me, but he was giving a sermon one time in Big Sandy, and he said, now look, anytime I ever bring up anything that you might not really believe or might not really agree with, you know, come in and let's have a talk. He said, I love a good argument. And I thought, what did he say there? I wasn't, you know, I don't like argument. If somebody can show that I've said something I shouldn't have said, that's one thing, but I don't like an argument. But he liked an argument. Well, I didn't go in and argue with him about whether you ought to argue or not. that wouldn't have worked. But if you love strife, you love transgression. It's going to happen. You can't say too much without getting into trouble. He that exalts his gate seeks destruction. There again, pride comes before a fall. Now, he that exalts his gate, Psalm 49, you know, we read about people name their houses after their names, and they put their name on their gate, you know, and they exalt their business and their name and their gate and all to try to prolong power and prestige. He that exalts his gate is asking for destruction. The unsinkable ship, the immortal city, the immortal Babe Ruth dead. All the immortals are dead, you know. That's kind of odd. Verse 20, he that has a perverse heart finds no good. He that has a perverse tongue falls into mischief. The word froward, same as perverse there. So there are two different ways, you know. You can have a perverse heart, or you can have a perverse tongue, and maybe you don't have a perverse tongue when you have a perverse heart. But if you go around with a perverse heart, you're not going to find good. You're always negative, always critical, always seeing the bad, always disbelieving. Verse 21, he that begets a fool does it to his sorrow, and the father of a fool has no joy. And, of course, the prodigal son illustrates that. While your son's out sowing his wild oats and justifying it, the dad has sorrow, and the dad has no joy. No matter all the other things you can do, if you have a son that causes sorrow, you have no joy. It just doesn't last. Nothing means much to you as a son, so nothing's going to have as permanent a bearing and pressure on you as a son. Now, I always wondered about verse 22, and finally caught up with it. I didn't believe it could say what it seems to say. A merry heart does good like a medicine. Well, it doesn't say that. It just says, a merry heart makes a good medicine. It's a remedy in itself. A merry heart makes a good medicine. It'll solve more of your ailments than anything else you'll get. Just by having a merry heart. You know, and how do you have a merry heart? Can you do anything about changing yourself that way? I know in Big Sandy, I used to have students, they'd come in, they'd say, I'm going to be happy when, and I'm going to be happy if. And I'd say, well, I can tell already you're not going to be, because you're always going to be happy when. You're going to be happy if. You know, you're either happy or you're not, and you can't say, I'm going to be happy when. And you could remind them when they said it last time, and when the when came, it didn't do what they thought it was going to do. So a lot of happiness is just in your basic makeup, you know. Are you a happy person or are you not? If you aren't, you need to change it, you know. You can do something about changing yourself from being a deadpan, sourpuss, Scrooge, or whatever, to being a happy person. A merry heart makes a good medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones. And they've literally proven that when a person is always depressed, negative, worry, fret, stew, high strung, all these adjectives we use, hyper active, you know, we've got a million of them. If a person has, by their very being, their very nature, they don't have a happy spirit, then the very marrow of your bones doesn't produce the red blood corpuscles, the red blood cells you need, then you just can't have you can't have health. Now, they've proven that many ways. They've proven, too, that it takes half as many muscles to smile as it does to frown. But we've seen that one before as well. A wicked man takes a bribe. That word gift is bribe in this case. So anybody that takes a bribe is wicked. They take it out of the bosom. That's where the Easterners wear their wallets, inside their belt around their waist, to pervert the ways of judgment. They don't want justice or judgment to happen. They want respect of persons. They want to advance their case. They don't want equity or fairness. They want themselves to be given something contrary to judgment. That's a wicked man. So a bribe is not a light matter in God's sight. Wisdom is before him that has understanding. But the eyes of a fool are in the ends of the earth. In other words, he can never see any understanding or wisdom. His eyes can go from east to west, north to south, and he's never looking for wisdom or understanding. But it's right there before him that has understanding. Verse 25, another one on kids. 21 is a verse on kids as well. Verse 17, you might want to just write friends right across the verse. I have anger written across verse 14. Okay, verse 25, a foolish son is a grief to his father and bitterness to her that bare him. Now, if you notice what we mentioned earlier, all of the first chapters of Proverbs talk about my son, my son, my son, all those 8 chapters of instruction. And then in these middle chapters, it just shows what's the opposite of a son that wouldn't take instruction. So they always talk about a foolish son, a fool, a son that causes shame. So the middle chapters are all the opposite of the first ones, and then he'll come back to my son toward the end here as we get that direction. A foolish son is a grief to his father and bitterness to her that bare him. So again, it shows the folly of a son affects the dad and the mom a little different ways. It can be a grief to his father. The man's vanity is a little different than the mother's, but it would be bitterness to the mother. To punish the just is not good, nor to strike princes for equity. He that has knowledge spares his words. A man of understanding is of an excellent spirit, or a cool spirit. He's not hasty, or he's calm, or collected, or at ease. A man of understanding is at ease. He's collected. He isn't radical. He isn't subject to outbreaks or outbursts. And somebody that has knowledge spares his words. You know, there are a lot of things you don't know anything about. You know, Will Rogers said we're all ignorant. We're just ignorant about different things. And that's true. So the next verse proves that. Even a fool is considered wise when he keeps his mouth shut. Why open your mouth and remove all doubt? You know, that's worded that way, and I think it's the Revised Standard Version. very vivid and very realistic. So that kind of backs up verse 27. If you have knowledge, you spare your words. So a fool, when he holds his peace, is counted wise. I remember a class we had in classical literature one time, and elders were in there, and ministers on sabbatical, and Dr. Hay was tracing all these tribes of Africa, you know, and he was reading this interlinear Greek and Latin, and I couldn't read either one of them, and here he's reading this interlinear Greek and Latin, and he's saying, well, let's see, here's a problem, and he'd dig in this interlinear Greek and Latin. He said, oh, undoubtedly, there's the answer to the problem, you know. And this one elder raised his hand, and Dr. Hay called on him. He said, well, Dr. Hay, what's the problem? Not only had he not seen the answer to it, he didn't even know what the problem was. Now, the fact was, I didn't either. But I'd read this proverb, and I knew to keep my mouth shut. So he should have read that proverb. He'd have saved some face there, you know. But even a fool, when he holds his peace, is counted wise. So a man that shuts his lips is a man of understanding. Chapter 18, through desire, a man, having separated himself, seeks and intermeddles with all wisdom. So you can take your life into your own hands and decide you're not just going to go along with everybody. You can have a desire and keep apart from the rest of the people around you. Just decide you're going to seek and intermeddle with all wisdom and have that desire and set yourself to do it. Separate yourself to do it. And just quit flowing along with life happening to you. I'm surprised how many people think life happens to them. But you've heard Mr. Armstrong say where people live, they really hadn't had anything to do with. That just happened to be where they were, and they never did leave it. And, you know, they always would like to go on somewhere else. They just never did do it. And you take your life into your own hands and do something with it. Verse 2, a fool has no delight in understanding, but that his heart may discover itself. That's psychology. Boy, that is exactly psychology. You let your carnal brain run in gear and sit and stand in awe of your own carnal brain running in gear. That is real stupidity, you know, of all the ignorance you ever heard of. But that's the way some kinds of fools are. They don't really bother to know. You know, sometimes people say, well, how do you know a good book when you see it? Well, one thing for sure, when you see the guy is more interested in expressing his writing ability than he is what he's writing about, I wouldn't buy that book. I'm not interested in a bunch of people's skills. You know, I'm interested in facts. I'm interested in simple truths or the plain truth. But some people show themselves fools because they don't really have any delight in understanding. They just like to rattle off their mouth. And I had a roommate like that over here on the third floor of Mayfair when I was a freshman. And Gary Cefak and I would get in there with the booklets and start marking them in our Bible, and this guy would come in, and since we were in the Bible, he'd talk Bible. But he'd just sit there and just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. You know, it kind of reminded me of that little saying they had up on the church wall in Eugene, Oregon. You go back and they have this little bulletin board, and it said, many people can talk religion by the mile, who can't walk it by the inch. And that's the way this guy was. You know, he just waste your time. Just take up all your time. Talk a blue streak. You know, he said more about nothing than anybody ever heard of. You know, they say that's what a specialist is. He learns more and more about less and less till he knows everything about nothing. Well, but when I read this verse too, I think of psychologists and psychiatrists, and they just stand around and study each other's carnal brains running in gear, you know. Put you on the couch and ask you a bunch of questions and study your carnal reasons. And that gets you nowhere. Well, verse 3, when the wicked comes, then comes also contempt. There's no right attitude when somebody that's wicked comes. You might as well get out of there and not expect anything. There's going to come reproach and contempt, and it just isn't going to work. Now, the words of a man's mouth are as deep waters, and the wellspring of wisdom as a flowing brook. So there again, you have to draw out somebody that has wisdom. The words of a man's mouth will be like deep waters. You might not really understand the wisdom that he's giving you. And you might have to think about it and say, yeah, you know, that is right. The more I think about that, the more I realize that's right. That's good wisdom, good counsel. So the words of a man's mouth are as deep waters, and the wellspring of wisdom, a flowing brook. Verse 5, it is not good to accept the person of the wicked. You can't wink your eye as a Christian and allow in a friend what you condemn in somebody else. It is not good to respect persons. Now, James had something to say about that, you know, about the rich coming in. He said, he'd sit right up here on the front seat, you know, and then a guy comes in, he's bib overalls, and he say, well, would you mind sitting in the basement down there, you know, and you could probably hear all right down there. And it is not good to accept the person. You can't judge with respect to persons. You commit sin if you judge with respect to persons. So it's not good to accept the person of the wicked to overthrow the righteous in judgment. Righteous are righteous and wicked are wicked, no matter who they are. A fool's lips. Now, the next three verses are all about the tongue, 6, 7, and 8. A fool's lips enter into contention. His mouth calls for strokes. The fool's mouth is his destruction. His lips the snare of his soul. The words of a whisperer or talebearer are like wounds, slugs, stabs, kicks in the shins. The words of a talebearer, gossiper, as wounds, they go down into the innermost parts of the belly. So the tongue is one of the main subjects of Proverbs. He also that is slothful in his work, there again you read the nature of that animal and you get a message here, is brother to him that's a great waster. But you know, for you to buy cheap things and they break, and you buy more cheap things and they break, and you buy more cheap things and they break, that's being brother to somebody that's slothful, just never really gets around to getting much because they're so slow and so full of excuses. So there are two different kinds that are parallel with each other, slothful and the great waster. The name of the Eternal is a strong tower. The righteous runs into it and is safe. So that's kind of like that trust. You flee for refuge. You run into the tower of God and you're safe. Now, verse 9 I've got a dollar bill mark on, and verse 11 is another dollar bill mark. The rich man's wealth, that's his security. That's his strong city. But if he ever loses it, boy, he'll find out he doesn't have any defense. It's like a high wall in his own conceit. But if he didn't have it, he wouldn't be looked to by anybody. Before destruction, the heart of man is haughty. Before honor is humility. Many times we've read that one. So as sure as you ever get haughty, you know what's ahead. Verse 13. Boy, this one's violated every day. People say, what do you think? I think. What do you believe? I believe, you know. Who gives a hang what anybody believes, you know? I'd like to know what people know. I don't want to know what people believe. Then you get majority believing that, and then you believe that? No. You can't go by majority. We'd all be, what, Hindus or Catholics? You can't go by that. So, notice, he that answers the matter before he hears it. That's natural to do, you know. If you're in a hurry and somebody wants to tell you a story and get your counsel, and you answer before you hear the whole thing, you may prove out to be a fool. It's folly and shame to him. So Mr. Armstrong always said, get all facts. Be always sure you get all facts. Don't answer a matter before you hear it. It may prove out to be folly and shame. Now, the spirit of a man will sustain his infirmity. If you're a positive, determined, vigorous person, you can overcome disease and eliminate an infirmity. Many a time, you've known that happen and seen that happen. But a wounded spirit, who can bear? It's just destructive, health-wise and otherwise. There, again and again, that same proverb, the heart of the prudent gets knowledge. The ear of the wise seeks knowledge. The ear of the wise is going to get away from fools and scorn and perverse, but their ear will go where there's wisdom and seek knowledge. A man's gift makes room for him and brings him before great men. Now that can either be taken in a good good connotation or a bad one. When you go in before a king, you may bring him a gift of some kind. And it makes room for you. So that's not wrong in God's sight for someone to be able to go before someone that's a great person and bring a gift before them. He that's first in his own case seems just, but his neighbor comes and searches him. Now that's not too clear, but boy, that's one of the wisest proverbs I've ever read. Because one person will come to you and tell you about a trouble, and you'll think, well, can you believe that? Boy, that is terrible. Wait till I see that person, the other party. And then, you know, then they come and you say, oh, well, no wonder. Oh, well, wait till I see that first person, you know. And that's one of the wisest proverbs I've ever read. It's one reason I don't counsel married problems individually, unless it's a special case, you know. I want to talk to both of them together. They kind of keep each other from unloading everything on you, you know, and kind of, well, wait a minute now, that wasn't exactly the way that was, you know. Now, you remember what you said and you did? So you kind of get the whole picture that way. But if one comes without the other knowing about it, boy, they'll unload on you to get your judgment toward them, and then the other comes and you're already prejudiced against them, you know. You already got all this load in your head that the other person unloaded on you, you know. And so you'll find out that proverb. I remember our kids one time running around, one of them banged their head, and I said, Gina, were you chasing Jeff? No, no. They were running around the table. He's chasing her. Well, that's play on words, you know. Who's chasing who when you're going around the table, you know? Now that, he that's first in his own case seems just, but the other comes and finds him out. That's the way the Revised Standard Version has it. The other comes and gives him away. That's the way another translation has it. Now, the lot causes contentions to cease. So where people are hassling about something and they can't agree, then you just cast lots. Reach your hand into a jar, and whoever gets the black marble or the white marble, whichever one which stands for, it's a chance way of deciding something or asking God to cause a lot to go the way he chooses. So the way of choosing by lot causes contentions to cease and parts between the mighty. Boy, now verse 19, that's another real dandy. A brother offended is harder to be won than a strong city. Now, you can imagine how hard it is to win a strong city. Well, a brother offended is just that hard to be won. So you're better off avoiding offense. Being careful, you know. If meat causes your brother to offend, Paul wouldn't eat meat as long as the earth stood. So it's easier not to offend a brother, to avoid offense. Their contentions are like the bars of a castle. That is almost impossible to break through. You can explain and expound and clarify and do all you want to, but once a brother is offended, their contentions are like the bars of a castle. Now, verse 20, again, all about the tongue. A man's belly shall be satisfied with the fruit of his mouth. Now, that means if you use your speech appropriately, maybe you can make a living that's suitable and you'll be full. Also, if the fruit of your mouth is appropriate, you won't have worry and fret and get ulcers. A man's belly is satisfied with the fruit of his mouth. So, you know, it's good to give a good answer. It's good to use your tongue wisely. You're always refreshed and encouraged by using your tongue properly. If you encourage somebody or you a word fitly spoken or a word in due season, we've read those, how good they are. Well, that's the same way with the fruit of your mouth. You can have a secure, established income and business, and people can trust your word. They can depend on your word. So you'll be trusted, and you'll have a secure business, and your belly will be satisfied. With the increase of his lips, he'll be filled. But death and life are in the power of the tongue. They that love it shall eat the fruit thereof. So be careful about what you say and how you say things. You know, one of the marriage books points out that in married couples, what they say is only about 13% of the difficulty between two people. how they say it is only about 30-some percent of it. And the setting, the air, the imputing of a motive is about 40-some percent of what people say. Now, that it shouldn't be that way, you know. That just shows when two people in a marriage, they really aren't going that much by what somebody says. They're literally going more by how they say it and the setting and air of it than they are even what's said. Now, that is ridiculous, you know. That shouldn't be that way. It looks like people are just walking around with chips on their shoulders. Knock it off. Go ahead. Just go ahead and knock it. You know, looking for trouble. Asking for trouble. Wanting a fight. Looking for an argument. Looking for a fight. Now, that's terrible. But death and life are in the power of the tongue. That's a frightening scripture. Now, verse 22. Whoso finds a wife finds a good thing. And whoever finds a wife obtains favor of the Eternal. So if God helps you find your wife, boy, you found favor of God and you find a good thing. Because when you think about living alone, you know, and the lessons you learn in being married, there are many fold more lessons you learn in being married than there are in being single. Now, verse 23, the poor uses entreaties, but the rich answers roughly. Now, the more you're around the rich, the more you'll see that. They don't have to be careful how they say anything. They don't have to be kind and cautious and gentle. And the poor do, though. They've got to use entreaties. They don't have anything else to go by. It's just what you say only. They don't have any prestige or money behind it or power or anything else. So the poor use entreaties. But boy, the rich, they don't have to be careful how they talk. They ought to be. God says they have to be. Doesn't make any difference who you are. You can't just ride roughshod over other people. The rich answers roughly. And that's bad news. That's wrong. Now, a real famous one on friends, just write friends across the verse, but a man that has friends must show himself friendly. Nobody likes to be friends with someone that isn't friendly. You know, if you're hard to approach, if you're unapproachable, if you're aloof, or if you're distant, then you're just not going to have that many friends. You've got to show yourself friendly to have friends. And again, as we read earlier, there is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. And a lot of us probably have friends that are closer than a lot of brothers. I know God said He'd give you brothers and sisters and mothers in this life many fold when you forsake them.